Do any of you know what this building was before it became the Schottenstein Center and the Shengshu? What? It was a school. Do you know what the school was? Right, it was the Rabbi Moshe Sal. How do you know that? So you're the only one who reads then, obviously, right? Yeah. So I didn't realize how I would feel being back in here. I haven't been in this building for approximately 51 years. And I have a sort of a special connection, actually, to this building because the principal of the Yeshiva, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, which for many years, for many decades, was the sort of the only Zionist yeshiva ketana in the upper end of Manhattan. The principal of this yeshiva was Rabbi Yitzchak Weinberg, whose son Raphael Weinberg was a classmate of mine here at at Yeshiva College and in studies for Smicha. He was also my brother-in-law, married to my sister, Aleha Shalom. They went on Aliyah he was actually also on the faculty at Stern College, and then went on Aliyah. They went on Aliyah with their four daughters in 1970. There were a variety of occasions when I would be here in those years. In any case, I didn't think that the place would sort of fill me with memories and feelings. So I would like to just take advantage of the opportunity to dedicate this learning that I'm about to do with you in memory of the elder Rabbi Yitzchak Weinberg, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and in memory of my sister, Masha Rachel Basarav Avram Verezel. Alright, so the title that I assigned to this was somewhat long. It had to do with the status of the government of Israel, particularly related to thoughts of Rav Kook and Rav Yashaber Soloveitchik. And then concluding with a sort of a modern midrash. So I want to start with a brief study of a part of a tshuva of Rav Kook, which requires a brief introduction. Rav Avram HaKohen Kook was born in 1865, and he moved to Eretz Yisrael, then under Ottoman rule, in 1904, to become the Rav in the city of Yaffa, where he was also responsible for the religious services, not only in the city, but in the surrounding region, which included numbers of secular kibbutzim. And he functioned, as you all know from your studies of Rav Kook, he functioned as an extraordinary bridge between Torah and secular communities in Israel. During the period of time that he lived in Yafo, there were a number of young men who established an organization called Hashomer, which was a Jewish self-defense group. Amongst the founders of that group were Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, who later became the second president of the State of Israel, David Ben Gurion, who was one of the founders and first Prime Minister of the State of Israel. Both of them had already in Europe had experience with creating Jewish self-defense groups, and they began to do that in Israel, based in Yafo. That's where they lived, and there, based in Yafo, they organized these Jewish self-defense groups, to which almost the entire rabbinate of Israel were opposed. That is, by and large, the rabbinate of Israel took the position that Jews should not act in their own self-defense, but even when they were being attacked, they should rely on the forces of the Turkish military, the military of the Ottoman Empire, to protect them, but they should not act aggressively themselves. Rav Kook disagreed, and Rav Kook then already became a significant supporter of the creation of Jewish self-defense groups. In fact, this controversy between Rav Kook and the rest, and much of the rest of the rabbinic leadership of Eretz Yisrael, continued throughout Rav Kook's life. With the outbreak of the First World War, Rav Kook happened to be in Europe. He was unable at that time to get back to Eretz Yisrael, and so he spent the war years, until 1917, he spent in Europe, part of that time in England, and part of that time in Switzerland. In Switzerland, he was in a town called St. Gallen, and during his stay there, he received a she'ela in the mail from someone whom he knew, and the question that was asked, which was eventually published in Mishpat Kohen, which was one of the volumes of Tshuvot of Rav Kook, this one on Hilchot Melachim, it's Simen Kuf Mem Dalid in Mishpat Kohen. The questioner asked Rav Kook the following question: how was it possible for the Hashmonaim to engage in war against the Syrian Greeks when everyone knows, said the questioner, that the authority to conduct war is vested by halacha only in Melech Yisrael? The Rambam includes the laws of war in Hilchot Melachim. The Mishnah codifies the laws of war in the context of its treatment of the conduct of kings and the relationship between king and Sanhedrin. But the Hashmonaim, said his questioner, were not legitimate kings. After all, they were Kohanim. And there was no king of Israel at that time. So how was it possible for them to conduct war? This question, arriving to Rav Kook at that point in time, led Rav Kook to understand that the questioner was not really interested in ancient Jewish history. That his issue was not the Hashmonaim. That his issue was, how could Rav Kook support Jews engaging in military action in a period of time when there was no Melech Yisrael, if the halakha only empowered the king to conduct military action? Right? You understand the question. So Rav Kook wrote a tshuva in answer to that question. Rav Kook's response to the question has two parts to it. The two parts both address the two stages of military action by the Hashmonaim, And it addresses as well two divergent theories under which military action can be undertaken. So Rav Kook offers the following. He says, first of all, in the initial stages of the wars of the Hashmonaim, you know what, says Rav Kook? Those were not wars. Those were not wars at all. Think for a moment about what was happening. The Syrian Greeks would come into a community. They would gather the entire community in the town square. They would take an elder from the community and bring him to the middle of the town square where they would have established an altar. And they would say to him, here, you sacrifice this pig to Zeus or else we will kill you. Says Rav Kook, what was that Jewish elder supposed to do under those circumstances? What was he supposed to do under those circumstances? So you tell me, what was he supposed to do? The Syrian Greeks had just told him that either you sacrifice this pig to Zeus or else we'll kill you. What was he supposed to do? Hello? Die? Really? What? So he should die. So he means he should stand there and he should stretch out his hands like this and lean his head over to one side and say, okay, go ahead, do me in. That's what he's supposed to do, says Rav Kook. What are you, out of your mind? Yavor doesn't mean that you stand there and you let yourself be killed. If someone orders you to do something on pain of death, if you fail to do it, and it's something that you are not permitted to do, which means you can't do it, then in reality, says Rav Kook, what is that person saying to you? He is simply telling you that he's going to kill you. So if somebody stands opposite you and he says, I'm going to kill you, is that what you do? You say, have a nice day. Go ahead, kill me. That what you're supposed to do? That is, you have a legal duty of self-defense. Therefore, says Rav Kook, for that old man standing there, he had a duty of self-defense. And not only based on their having told him that he has to sacrifice an idol to Zeus, because if it's Shat Hashmad, if it's a period of religious oppression, then even if they tell you to do anything which is violation of Torah, even if it's not one of the three laws which are Yehareh Va'al Ya'avor, you are duty bound to resist. Not simply to give up and tell someone to kill you, but to resist. It means to resist even in a situation in which you know you will die in resistance because you do not believe you can succeed. But your duty is to resist. But if this old man's duty was to resist, says Rav Kook, how's about all of those other people who were standing around on the outskirts of this circle, who heard the Greeks say to this man, either worship Zeus or else we'll kill you? Do they have any obligation in that situation? Are they just voyeurs entitled to stand there and watch the execution? Is that what they're supposed to do? What are they supposed to do? Answer? Why? Based on Lo Tamur al Damreyacha. You have a legal duty of rescue. You have a legal duty of rescue when another, certainly under Lo Tamur al Damreyacha, when a fellow Jew his life is being threatened, you have a legal duty of rescue in relation to that person. Says Rav Kook, you know what was going on in those initial wars of the Greeks? Had nothing, of the Hashmonaim, had nothing to do with Hilchot Milchama. And that's why it had nothing to do with Hilchot Melachim. These were simply instances in which Jews were obligated by Halakha to act in self-defense. The individual who was under threat
And every other Jew who was aware of that threat, they were all obligated to resist in order to achieve the defense of the lives of Jews. Therefore, says Rav Kook, it has nothing to do with milchama, and therefore has nothing to do with Hilchot Melachim. That is, the engagement in self-defense, he argued, does not require the presence of Melech Yisrael to lead in battle. All it requires is the existence of the threat, and in the face of the existence of the threat, everyone is obligated to engage in the resistance to the threat in order to rescue Jewish lives. That's the first part. Then Rav Kook goes on to the second part. And Rav Kook says, of course, we all know that the Hashmoneim also engaged in wars later on, after they had defeated the Syrian Greeks. They also engaged in other kinds of wars, which may not have been entirely and purely self-defense. Has not those wars, says Rav Kook, to which he answers as follows. Yes, it is true, he says, that conducting milchama is within the exclusive domain and authority of Melech. However, he says, it's necessary to distinguish between two sets of laws related to Melech Yisrael. There is the set of laws related to Melech Yisrael that has to do with Melech Mibet David. It has to do with a king of the household of David, who is appointed by a Navi and the Sanhedrin, and to whom all sorts of special and distinctive regulations apply, because in his status, in his personal status, he is Melech Yisrael. And because he is Melech Yisrael, he is obligated to write a Sefer Torah la'atzmo, and he is obligated to carry that Sefer Torah with him wherever he goes. And he is obligated not to have excessive number of wives, and he is forbidden from having a standing army with too many horses, and he is forbidden from leading the people back into Mitzrayim for whatever purpose. Those are all laws that regulate the Melech Mibet David. But says Rav Kook, you know, there is another dimension to the powers of Melech. The other dimension to the powers of Melech are the powers that involve the regulation of the Jewish state. Says Rav Kook, stop and think for a moment. You mean to tell me that if there is no Melech Mibet David, if there is no Melech Mibet David, that the Jewish people are not entitled to defend themselves? That the Jewish people are not entitled to impose taxes that would collect funds in order to build roads and to provide fundamental services to the population? None of that can happen unless there is a Navi. And if there's no Navi, there can be no Melech Mibet David, and therefore no Melucha, nothing, no governance of Jewish society. Of course not, says Rav Kook. And he then uses a simple piece of sort of political theory to make the following argument. Says Rav Kook, what is clear in halacha is that if there is no Melech Mibet David, that the powers of Melech, which relate to the essential services and needs of the Jewish society, revert, he says, to the Ummah Bichlala, revert to the entire people. And once they revert to the entire people, the people have the authority to delegate those powers to whomever they see fit, as a way of assuring that the needs of the nation, the needs of the people will be satisfied. Therefore, says Rav Kook, you know, when the Rambam talks about the authorities of Melech, the Rambam, in a variety of situations, uses the following kind of language. It says, Roshei galayot shebabavel, bimakom melech hein omdim. V'yesh lahem lirdot et Yisrael b'chol makom. Right? Even in Chutz Laaretz, even the Reish Galuta had the authority of Melech. Why did he have the authority of Melech? Because he was, as it were, delegated those powers by the Am. The Rambam says this repeatedly. The Ramban says it with great frequency. The Ramban, for example, at the end of his Mitzvot Lo Ta'aseh, at the end of his Hosafot, right, at the end of the Ramban's Hosafot to the Rambam's Sefer HaMitzvot, in the section on Lo Ta'aseh, the Ramban says, Al HaMelech, O Al HaShofet, Umi Shaha'am B'Rushuto, Lahutzi'am L'Tzava, B'Melchemet Rushut O Mitzvah. Says Rav Kook, how could you want it more explicit? The Ramban tells us explicitly that the authority of leading the Am in Milchama is not only an authority of Melech mi Beit David, whoever is the Melech, even if he is not mi Beit David, or whoever is the Shofet, or mi Shaha'am B'Rushuto, has the authority Lahutzi L'Tzava B'Milchama B'Milchemet Rushut O Mitzvah. In that regard, says the Ramban, that's how Yehoshua, who was the Moshel HaRishon, Asher Pakid Al Ha'ida, likewise, a whole set of Rishonim, whom Rav Kook quotes, who clearly, precisely understood it to be the case, that the Din Melech applied in the absence of Melech Beit David to whomever the Am had selected and had assigned those authorities. The authority to lead the Am in war, the authority to tax, the authority to draft, right? All of those regulatory authorities which are necessary for the conduct of the nation, for the safety, security, and well-being of the nation, are all part of Din Melech. In this sense, says Rav Kook, that these powers revert to the Am in the absence of Melech Mibeit David, and the Am delegates them. That was the basic framework of the response of Rav Kook, right? So Rav Kook is really saying two separate things. First, he's saying, not every war falls under Dinei Milchama. There are some wars for which you don't even need Dinei Milchama. They're just sort of extended forms of self-defense, which itself is a fascinating analytic proposition, and the truth is that it makes an enormous difference halakha l'maaseh, because laws of war are much more restrictive than laws of individual self-defense. Albeit in some instances, laws of individual self-defense may be, in one way or another, quite different. And for example, the debate that's recorded both in Bavli and Yerushalmi around the question of whether preemptive war is to be classified as a milchemet mitzvah or as a milchemet rushut is fundamentally dependent on your conception of the nature of preemptive war. Whether preemptive war is actually a war of self-defense, or whether preemptive war is a personal act of defense when there is no war. If it's the latter, the individual does not have the authority to strike preemptively in personal self-defense. The nation may have the right to strike first in preemptive self-defense. So how you classify wars, whether you classify them as really under Hilchot Milchama or under the Halachot of self-defense, can make an enormous difference halacha l'maaseh. But the critical issue, it seems to me, in Rav Kook, aside, the implications of that, practically, because Israel has, of course, engaged numbers of times in preemptive strikes. And the second element of the position of Rav Kook obviously has extraordinary implications in contemporary times. Because while Rav Kook himself died in 1935, did not have the zchut to see Kum HaMdina, at the time of Kum HaMdina, the question then of what exactly is the status and the authority of the secular government of the state of Israel according to halakha is deeply impacted by this analysis of Rav Kook. Because it's obvious then that according to the analysis of Rav Kook, the authority of the secular government of the state of Israel is what authority? Is the authority of Melech Yisrael, having been delegated those authorities by the Imam Bichlala, by the Am residing, by Am Yisrael residing in Eretz Yisrael, having delegated to the Knesset the authority of governance of the nation, then the Knesset and its in turn delegation of some of its authority to specific individuals like the Prime Minister, all of those exercises of authority would have the status of dimelech, which would mean that if the government orders someone to be drafted, then that's dimelech. Then it's part of the law, the right of government to order drafting. If the government orders that taxes be paid, then the payment of those taxes are dimelech, and the failure to pay those taxes may constitute morig b'malchus. But you understand, obviously, the significance of that. You can also understand why, even within religious Zionist circles, there has been hesitancy about giving full play to this particular position of Rav Kook. But I'd like to move for a moment from Rav Kook to Rav Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik. After 1967, as you're all aware, there was enormous controversy in Israel and in Jewish communities throughout the world around the question of territorial compromise. And the debate that then took place around the issue of whether Israel should be ready to offer territorial compromise in exchange for what Israel would consider to be a real peace became a matter to which not only politicians addressed themselves and not only some citizens addressed themselves to, some citizens of Israel and Jews throughout the world, but Gedolei Torah, Poskim all over the world began to address themselves to this particular issue. And dominantly, what Poskim began to say was that it is usur for a government of Israel to return territory in the interest of peace. So they put it differently, a variety of them put them in different ways. Lubavitcher Rebbe at the very beginning in 1967, I'll come back to him a little bit later, Lubavitcher Rebbe Zatzal, at first said, it's also actually on the grounds of Lo Techanein. The young Rav Kook's son also said the same thing. Many other Rabbanim Gedolim said, no, it's usher because of Lo Techanein. The usher of Lo Techanein, you're not permitted to give non-Jews any form of ownership in the land of Israel. You're certainly not allowed to give up sovereignty in order to, for any purpose. Most of them eventually sort of changed their bases, even though they didn't necessarily change their position. So eventually, for example, the Lubavitcher Rebbe began to argue it's not a question really of Lo Techanein, because it became clear that Lo Techanein could not found such a position. But it's not really a matter of Lo Techanein, it's a matter of believing in the line. What do you do? God gave us this land. You're going to spit in God's face. You're going to tell him you don't want the land that he just gave you. There was this whole debate that was going on for a long period of time. Within the context of that, Rabbi Yosher Ber Soloveitchik sort of stood out as one person who maintained that territorial compromise in the interest of peace would be permissible according to halacha. He said, but you know what? This is not a matter for psak halacha. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, what I say and what all of the other Gedolei Yisrael say is absolutely and totally irrelevant to this question. The only relevancy of this question is to the government of the state of Israel. Because the halakha assigns to Melech Yisrael the responsibility for the security of the Am. That's why it gives Melech Yisrael the authority to go to war. And that's why the authority to go to war is always a discretionary authority. When someone becomes Melech Yisrael, he does not automatically have to go to war against Amalek instantaneously. He doesn't automatically have to go to war for Kibush Eretz Yisrael and go like the Ramban. Because there's no mitzvah to lose a war. There's mitzvah to fight wars when you know you can succeed. Therefore, said Rav Soloveitchik, that authority, the authority to make that decision as to what is in the best interest of the security of the Am, whether to hold territory and war to hold it, or to attempt to enter into peace with the possibility that you may still have to go to war in order to maintain the peace, even if you've given it up. Those are all risks that are within the discretionary authority of Melech Yisrael, and therefore he said, the only ones who can make that decision are not poskim, and not generals, and not armchair generals. Those decisions are to be made by the government of the state of Israel, and when it makes its decision, we should all be ready to say that we are makabel that decision, because they are authorized to make it. We can personally disagree, but we can't claim religious authority for our disagreement. So Soloveitchik clearly took the position that the government was Melech Yisrael. In fact, in later years, in the late 1970s, after Menachem Begin had become the Prime Minister of Israel, and at one point Menachem Begin was coming to the United States and had communicated his desire to meet with Rav Soloveitchik. It was sort of a difficult period because Begin was going ahead with the peace treaty with Egypt, and there was a lot of controversy about that. The Lubavitcher Rebbe had sent an intense message to Menachem Begin saying that he should absolutely not enter into this peace treaty with Egypt, that he should not give up the Sinai, so Begin was under a lot of pressure from lots of different directions. Be that as it may, Menachem Begin indicated his desire to meet with Rav Soloveitchik while he was here, and the message that he sent was that he would come up to Boston arriving in New York, that he would then come up to Boston to visit with Rav Soloveitchik, and Rav Soloveitchik sent back a response saying he would be glad to meet with him, but he will come to New York, he said, because it's not appropriate for a Nasi to come to a private person, no matter who he is. Kvod Melech requires that he come to the Nasi. Third element in Rav Soloveitchik's approach really is a very early article. It's one of the very few articles that Rav Soloveitchik had published as a relatively young man. It was in 1933, soon after he had come here to the United States. He contributed an article to a volume in honor of Dr. Bernard Revel. And in that volume, he published an article on the topic of women and war. Right? Women and war. It's an absolutely fascinating article from a whole host of different perspectives, both in terms of what the Rav's thinking was at that time and in terms of his later thinking about women and the relationship of women to mitzvot. The core position that the Rav took in this article is that according to the Rambam, he maintained that it is clear that the melech has the authority to draft women for milchama. Certainly so for milchamet mitzvah. That whereas the Rambam's position, at least in the Sefer HaMitzvot, it's more equivocal in the Mishnah Torah, but in his Akdamat of the Sefer HaMitzvot, the Rambam seems clearly to indicate that women are p'turot from participation in Milchemet Rashut. When it comes to Milchemet Mitzvah, he said, it seems really unequivocal that the Rambam was in fact taking the position, despite the fact that he's aware that later interpreters were really outraged at the idea that the Rambam might be taking such a position, and so they argued all sorts of arguments why that's not really pshat in the Rambam. Says the Rav, that's pshat in the Rambam. The Rambam maintains that women are subject to draft, to go to war in the Milchemet Mitzvah. However, he said, the fact that women are subject to a draft does not mean that the king is obligated to draft them. Right? The king's responsibility, he said, is to create a military force that will enable him to be victorious in the wars that he fights. The melech, therefore, has to determine whether his purposes, and thereby the purposes of the nation, will be best achieved by drafting women or by not drafting women. So women are in principle subject to the draft, but it remains within the discretionary authority of the king to decide whether to draft them or not. So this was already in the 1930s, right? Again, you know, some 20 years, more than 20 years before, you know, more than, like 15 years before Qom HaMdina. And before people in the Medina began to argue over the question of drafting women, and began to argue over the parallel question of drafting Talmidei Chachamim or Talmidei Yeshivot, not necessarily Talmidei Chachamim, that's a, you know, be an unfair way of characterizing it, right? Whether you draft Talmidei, you know, Talmidei Yeshivot. And Rav Soloveitchik's position was clear and unequivocal. That is, the Melech Yisrael had the authority in regard to any Milchemet Mitzvah to draft every citizen, right? Arguing out of the language of the Mishnah of Hakol Yotzin, Avinu Chatame Chedro V'Kalame Chupata, right? The Mishnah borrowing the language of the Navi Yoel, right? I mean, that's it. Everybody is subject to the draft. But in all such situations, the Melech has the authority of using his discretion to determine how he can best constitute a military force that will best protect the nation. So, I mean, it's interesting, of course, you know, to look at that right now as the government is involved in negotiations related to the Supreme Court in Israel having overturned the Tal law, so that they now have to come up with some other kind of resolution related to the question of exemptions for military service of Bachurim Yeshiva. And again, the critical issue is not, you know, whether Poskim will say that it's asur to draft Bachurei Yeshiva or not. The critical question will be whether Melech Yisrael, whether the government of the Medina determines that it is most in the interest of the security of the nation to draft or not. Now, which brings me, in the few minutes that I have left, to a modern midrash. The modern midrash that I would like to share with you is that what I mean by a modern midrash is that it is a non-existent midrash, but one that I am making up for the purpose of a discussion that I would like to have with you for a few moments, and it's a midrash that I am making up based on Parshat Beshalach. Parshat Beshalach is of course best known for two things. First, it's Beshalach Paro et Ha'am, Lo Nacham Lo Kim, right? They didn't send Nacham out, right? The old yeshivish question about why Nacham wasn't sent out, etc. Okay. And of course, Mishirat Hayah. But the most interesting things in this parsha really happened after Shirat Hayah. After Shirat Hayam, the Am is in... I can't describe it and I can't understand it. The Am is in such a state that it's beyond comprehension. Right after Shirat Hayam, the very next thing the Torah tells us is what? What did the Israel say right after Shirat Hayam? No water, we're going to die of thirst. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu sweetens the water. No food, no food. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, okay, no food. I'll give you man, I'll give you slav. You'll stuff yourselves on the slav, you'll be happy. They get the man, they get the slav. And after they've got the man and the slav, there's no water again. Again, they're complaining about water, right? This is endless, endless complaining, right? I mean, who could believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu could have tolerated such an existence? In the midst of that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu orders Moshe, and Moshe orders Aaron to do something very strange. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Moshe says to Aaron, Vayom Moshe El Aaron, right, this is in the Shemot HaZayim, Pasuk Lamed Gimel, Vayom Moshe El Aaron, Kach Tzimtzenet Achat, V'ten Shama Melo Omer Man, V'hanach Oto Lefnei Hashem L'mishmeret L'dorotechem. Moshe says to Aaron, take a jug, put in an omer, a measure of man in it, and keep it as a mishmeret. Right, well, eventually it will go into the Kodesh HaKadashim, according to Chazal. Keep it as a mishmeret ledorotechem. For what purpose? For what purpose is it? Is there to keep a jug of man ledorotechem? What? I mean, if somebody in the future disbelieves that there was a miracle of the man, they're going to pull out this jug and they're going to see it really was man. Right? So the person will, you know, stick his finger into it and say, man, there's sand in there. Right? Or, oh, I'll send it to the lab and we'll test it and we'll find out what it really is. Right? You're going to prove to somebody that there was a miracle of man because he's got a jug full of some kind of a strange, you know, vegetable or mineral material. Hey, come on! I mean, if Jews are not going to believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, after all the miracles they saw, they're going to believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu because of a jug of man. Why is this man l'dorotechem? But then, even after all of this battling over food, right? I mean, that's why. Okay, not going to talk about that. That's why food is so important, right? Alright, right after that, next thing that happens is toward the very end of the parasha, Vayavo Amalek Vayelachim Yisrael B'Refidim. So Moshe tells Yoshua B'Chalon Anashim, right, go out, say Yelachim Amalek, but meanwhile, I'll stay back here, right? And so Moshe stays back, and Moshe Givad and Aaron and Hur hold his hands up, right, as long as his hands are up, Bnei Yisrael defeat Amalek, and when his hands come down, Bnei Yisrael are losing, so Moshe obviously has an interest in keeping his hands up, and Chazal have this famous question, right, the question of the Mishnah, right, okay. And the very end of that, the very last pasuk of the parsha of Man is, the parsha of Amalek is, Vayomer ki yad al kisya milchama l'Hashem ba'Amalek midor dor. God's oath is that there will be a war between God and Amalek midor dor. But what is that? And what's the relationship between the jug of mana, the dorotechem, and the memory of Amalek midor dor? So to that question, I will offer you the following midrash. The midrash does not say, but maybe someday it will. Maybe in the various manuscripts that are discovered in the remaining fragment of the Gemiza, they will discover a midrash that says the following. Bnei Yisrael say to Moshe, God can't be with us now. What's going on here? We're thirsty, we're hungry. I thought we were in the whole land already. You expect us to believe in God? You expect us to believe in the presence of God and in the gula that God brought in the face of hunger and deprivation? That's the gula. Say Bnei Yisrael to Moshe. So Moshe conveys that to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He says, you know, they're having a crisis of faith, says Moshe to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They're having a crisis of faith. And they just can't believe that, you know, that you're really with them. And this is Gula. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I don't want to talk to you about it right now. Just do me a favor, take a jug, put some manna in it, and keep it l'dor teichem. And Am Yisrael moves on, and shortly thereafter, they're attacked by Amalek. And Am Yisrael turns to Moshe Rabbeinu, and they say to Moshe Rabbeinu, Meshala, this is Gula? What? You gotta be kidding. This is Gula? I mean, I thought Gula means perfection. We thought Gula means no more wars. We thought Gula means no more evil in the world. This is, you expect us to accept this, to accept God as having redeemed us when this is what we're confronting in the world? So Moshe conveys that to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And he says, you know, they're having a difficult time believing that they're living in the era of Gula, because look at it. I mean, they're at war with Amalek. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe, yeah. You don't understand, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There will be war with Amalek, midor dor. My war and your war. Because Gula does not resolve all challenges of faith. And Gula does not eliminate all evil in the world. But Gula will have given you, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Moshe, two new tools with which to deal with your issues of faith and with which to deal with the way in which you understand or need to combat evil in the world. And those two tools are your liberty, your freedom as individuals and as a nation, and Torah. This is Gula, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There will be more Gula to come. But Gula will never fully resolve challenges to faith. It will never involve the total elimination of evil. But it will give you gradually the tools to enable you to strengthen faith, to enable you to battle evil in the world. So I don't know, because I didn't read the end of this midrash yet, I don't know whether Bnei Yisrael were convinced. But they went ahead. And in 1967, when the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zatzal, announced that what was happening in 1967 were nisim gluim, were absolute, unequivocal miracles, that the hand of Hashem was absolutely manifest in history. When the Rav in Kol Dodi Dofeik had spoken about the not only the sound of God, not only the calls of God, but the capacity to experience the immediacy of God's engagement in our history in this world, in our redemptive history. The Satmar Rebbe wrote a new 2-volume work. The title of it, title of it was Al-Habullah, the Al-Habullah, which loosely translated means concerning redemption and betrayal, in which the Sakya Rebbe argued that all of these people who are declaring that the victory in the war in 1967 was a new mark of the divine hand in history, of the redemptive hand of God in history, says the Sakya Rebbe, they're wrong. In fact, this is simply a challenge by the Sitra Achra. We have to reject Zionism, reject autonomy, reject the separate state. And in fact, those people who say that it's Gula are making a mistake. Look at the Jewish world, he says. 80% of the Jewish world doesn't believe in anything Jewish. Look at the reality of the external world, filled with wars and evil. This you're going to claim is an era of Gula? No, he says. These people are betraying the trust of Am Yisrael. So the voice in Allah Gula Vala Turah is the voice of Bnei Yisrael in the Midbar, saying, oh, you really want us to believe, you really want us to believe that this is Gula, when we're hungry and thirsty and are short of faith as well as short of food, and when we're confronted by evil and we're confronted by terrorists, right? You want us to believe that that's Gula. That was the voice of Am Yisrael in the desert. And for that they had to remain in the desert for 40 years in order to extirpate that spirit from amongst them. But the voice of HaKadosh Baruch Hu was the voice that called to us to recognize that Gula and our perception of Gula should not be betrayed by the presence, the continued presence of challenges to faith and even of challenges to our lives continuing to exist in the world. What we need to be able to respond to in the voice of Hashem is the realization that we have been gifted throughout our history with extraordinary tools, extraordinary kelim, with the Torah and its mitzvot. We have been gifted now, in this era, with a Medina of our own, with the autonomy of a Jewish state, able, if we are successful, to embody within itself the best of the values that Torah has taught us, the best of the way in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to live our lives. And that being so gifted that we don't have the right to deny, to question whether this is an era of Geula. It is an era of Geula. We need to be capable of affirming that despite all of the challenges. And we need to learn how to use the tools that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has granted us to move the world and to move Am Yisrael to an ever stronger position in our faith and in our combat with evil. So Chag Sameach to all of you, and may we have many, many more years of celebration together. Until, who knows, someday, maybe there really will be a Geula that is Shleima. And may we all be Zocha to see that day. Thank you very much.